Turn, if you would, to Gospel of Luke, chapter 22. This is near the end of Jesus' life. The Last Supper is over. Judas is on his way to betray Christ, and the disciples know that. It is just before Gethsemane, and Jesus knows that. And Jesus is speaking with the rest of his disciples, all but Judas. And beginning in verse 27 of Luke 22, Jesus says, "For who is greater, the one who is at the table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who's at the table? But I am among you as the one who serves. You are those who have stood by me in my trials, and I confer on you a kingdom, just as my Father conferred one on me, so that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel." Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift you as wheat. But I've prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail. And when you've turned back, strengthen your brothers. But he replied, "Lord, I'm ready to go to prison and death." And Jesus answered, "I tell you, Peter, before the rooster crows today, you will deny three times that you know me." Then Jesus asked them, all of them, "When I sent you without purse, bag, or sandals, did you lack anything?" "Nothing," they answered. He said to them, "But now, if you have a purse, take it, and also a bag. And if you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one. It is written, 'And he has numbered with the transgressors.' And I tell you that this must be fulfilled in me. Yes, it was written about me, or what is written about me is reaching its fulfillment." The disciples said, "See, Lord, here we have two swords." "That's enough," he replied. And Jesus went out as usual to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples followed him. Being numbered with the transgressors, boy, do we avoid that. Adventurers gamble with their very lives. I venture to say that fewer people are willing to be numbered with the transgressors. We're not even taught that. It's just come so natural. The child whose hand is caught in the proverbial cookie jar and has the cookie in his hand, and the parents just look at him or her. Where does the cookie go? Behind their back. Why? So they won't be numbered as a transgressor. That's an unusual phrase, numbered as a transgressor. Counted. There are 10 transgressors here, and you're one of them. 3 people are arrested for breaking into a jewelry store. You don't want to be one of those 3 counted as a transgressor. We just hate that. You ever broken something when you were a child or when you were an adult that didn't belong to you? And so you put it back together as best you could, so that no one would know, so that you would not be counted as a transgressor. I don't know if this happened to you, but it's happened to me on both sides. As a child gets older, and they're around a table or spent a lot of time in a home together with their parents, things are jovial, things are festive, people are laughing. And then the child says, "Do you remember back 20 years ago? Remember that lamp that no one broke? That was me." I don't think we do those things because we've gotten older and wiser, more spiritual. I think we just imagine that the statute of limitations is passed. And although I confess, I still won't be counted as a transgressor because time's gone by and we're laughing and it's now funny where it wouldn't have been at the time. Many, many years ago, I had an uncle who went to prison for about 4 or 5 years. I don't actually know how many years he was in jail because nobody talks about that. But I did know. Many years later, not too many years back from now, another one of my uncles used to take pictures out of all of our family reunions. Do you have relatives who do that? Every year he took motion pictures and still pictures. And then later when we were able to compile them all with our new technology, not too many years ago, they were all put together and the family could sit and watch 15, 20 years of family reunions go by in about 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 35 minutes we sat and watched this. And what was interesting is with many of my cousins, we sat and watched as a group picture would show from 1 year, then another year, then another year, and another year, and all of my aunts and uncles would be in the picture together. And then there was one picture where my uncle was missing, but my aunt was there. And then the next year, the same. And then the next year, the same. And one of my adult cousins hollered out, "Where's Uncle So-and-so?" Because he never knew. It was embarrassing to even have an uncle who is numbered as a transgressor. We just avoid that. It's funniest in sports. Almost nobody ever commits a foul in basketball. The refs are always wrong. In hockey, there's a man laying on the ice with his nose smashed over on his face. A penalty is called, and the guy's, "What? He hit himself in the stick with his own, in the face with his own stick. I didn't do anything." Same in basketball. Bodies all over the place. "What? I didn't do anything." Because nobody ever wants to be numbered as a transgressor. It's more difficult, though, when you're not a transgressor. Have you ever been falsely accused? That's hard. You can defend yourself, but sometimes doesn't that almost make you feel like you're appearing to be more guilty? Like you can't win whether you choose to be silent or defend yourself? It is not pleasant to be accused, numbered amongst the transgressors when you are not even a transgressor. Ever been misunderstood, misinterpreted? People quote you and it's not what you said. Someone falsely questions your motives. "Oh, I know why they did that." You don't know why they did that. That hurts. It's not desirable. It's painful to be numbered amongst the transgressors, especially when you were not transgressing. In extreme cases, as was mentioned earlier by the book that was portrayed on the screen, an innocent man or an innocent woman could go on trial for something they did not do. And we would always want to think, well, you know, justice will prevail. The truth will win out. But what if it doesn't? What if you go before the courts and you're innocent, but they don't see it that way, and you are convicted and then sentenced? I can't imagine anything much more awful than that. So why did Jesus have to be numbered with transgressors in the first place? Because his situation was like that worst situation where he went to trial and he was convicted not just to serve time, but to be crucified. Why did Jesus have to be numbered with the transgressors? Well, for one thing, to be an encouragement to us when we are. Jesus, much earlier in his ministry, at one of his first sermons, right after the Beatitudes in Matthew chapter 5, said, "Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you, and now Christ himself." And I suppose there's times later in life where even the disciples found encouragement from Christ's example in that. But that doesn't do much for the context of the text that we just read. I don't believe it was much encouragement on that day when Jesus said, "I must be numbered amongst the transgressors," knowing that Judas had already left, knowing that Judas was going to betray Christ, knowing the Romans and the Jewish leadership would be involved. To the disciples, it had to seem a lot more like a plan that had failed. A plan to establish a kingdom, to change the powers that be, to be right next to the person who changed the world when he did it. To the disciples, if he were to become numbered with the transgressors, it would be a king who almost was crowned. A life that almost amounted to something. A cause that we committed to that almost made it. And why did Jesus speak of a kingdom and then turn around in the next breath and tell us about all the hard times that were coming and that I will be numbered with the transgressors? There are two scriptures that quote that Jesus would be numbered with the transgressors. The one that we read is not the one that the disciples had, because they became that story. But let's go through that passage and look at what was going on in the hearts and minds, as best as we can tell, of Christ and his disciples. Jesus mentioned about the kingdom in beginning in verse 28. He said, "You are those who have stood by me in my trials, and I confer on you a kingdom, just as my Father conferred one on me, so that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones, judging the tribes of Israel." Is that an upstatement or what? Of all people, I think Peter is all over that one. He's loving that. They were just having an argument in this passage, but before we started reading, about who was going to be the greatest one in the kingdom. And then in a quiet voice, I'm sure, because it fits the context and because Jesus repeated his name, he looks at Peter and says, "Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift you as wheat. I prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail. And when you turn back, strengthen your brothers. Well, that just doesn't fit Peter's response to the first statement. Peter's response better fits Peter's mind, which would be obvious. But he replied, "Lord, I'm ready to go to prison and to death." That doesn't make much sense either if you're planning on a kingdom, does it? I don't even think he meant, "I really go to prison and death." I'm assuming what he meant is, "I'm willing to take up swords and we'll go take on these Romans. And if we fail and I go to prison or death, I'm okay with that. But I don't think we'll fail. We're going to do some damage today. I'm ready for this. I'm pumped. I was born for this. All my adult life, this is the cause I've been waiting for. I am ready to go to prison or to die. Let's not sit on our hands. Let's go." But Jesus replied, "I tell you, Peter, before the rooster crows today, you'll deny 3 times that you even know me. You don't even know your heart." I doubt that Peter sat down and said, "Oh, now I understand. I just think." He tucked those miserable words away in his heart for now. But then Jesus turned to the rest of them and talked about their purses. Do you remember when I sent you out? This was when he sent them out to witness in the towns. And he said, don't take a purse and don't take a bag or even sandals. Were you lacking anything? Was that not a great thing that you did? Didn't everything go just right? And they said, "We didn't lack anything." And basically, he says, it's not going to be like that now. He said, "Now, if you have a purse, take it. Take all the money you have. Take your driver's license. Take all your stuff you're going to need. Take your bag, too. And if you have a sword, take your sword. If you don't have one, sell your coat and buy one. There are difficult days coming." So he talked about Peter. There's difficult days. There's a kingdom coming. But Peter, there's difficult days coming for you. Be strong in the end. I'm praying. The rest of you guys, there's difficult days coming. And then he focuses attention on himself. And he says, it is written, and he was numbered with the transgressors. And I tell you, this must be fulfilled in me. I've got difficult days ahead. Yes, what is written about me is reaching its fulfillment. The word, "I tell you that this must be fulfilled in me," is it's duty to be fulfilled in me. It has no choice but to be fulfilled in me. It has to happen. And the disciples said, "See, Lord, here are 2 swords. And I don't think he meant that's enough, as in, I think 2 will be okay. I think what he meant was, the discussion is over. His disciples said, "See, Lord, here we have 2 swords. And he said, "That's enough." And he got up, as usual, and walked the Mount of Olives. You've heard what you need to hear. We don't have to discuss anything else. Let's go to the garden. And it was. It says Jesus went out as usual to the Mount of Olives. That was nothing like usual. It seemed like usual. It was the same time of day. Earlier in the passage, it said every night he would talk to his disciples and then go to the garden. It was that same time of night. It was the same garden. It was the same route. But this wasn't the usual time. This was a time that Christ knew that he would be sweating drops of blood in prayer. He already knew the difficulty he was going to have because he would tell his disciples, "Don't sleep on me. I need you now." And this was the time that he would walk into the garden and be arrested. And the things that needed to be fulfilled would be fulfilled. Patrick showed a video before he spoke where they talked to people on the streets about what does the crucifixion mean? It'd be interesting to try and picture what if they stuck a camera in Peter's mouth at this point in time. What does the crucifixion have with Christianity? Have to do with Christianity? How does it play a role? Wow, I hope it doesn't. That would be a bad ending. Rome should have some impact. A throne. I can see banners. More olive branches. I can see a lot of things, but wow, if it comes to crucifixion, man, I hope not. Peter didn't have an understanding yet. And I don't know when they did this, but there was a time when the apostles who were there that night figured out what Jesus was saying to them through this discussion. Especially what it meant for him to be numbered with the transgressors. I doubt it was that night. I doubt it was in the next day. I doubt it was until after the resurrection. Or maybe those 3 days in between. And they sat around, numbered with the transgressors. He said it was written somewhere. It's got to be the Old Testament. Who's got their electronic concordance with them? Tell me where that's found. And nobody had an electronic concordance with batteries in it. And one had left it at home. And said, well, who's got their Strong's concordance with them? And they said, well, like, I'm going to carry my Strong's concordance with me everywhere I go. I knew I should have bought one of those. I know what we'll do. We'll call Jerry. Jerry, where's that phrase that says numbered with the transgressors? They may have had to call someone who knew. Or I wonder, did those fishermen know the Old Testament so much better than we did that in a few minutes' time they could find that passage? But I know they found that passage. It wasn't a special code. It wasn't a secret message. It was just the prophecy that has to take place. He said it had to happen. Why? The answer wouldn't be in this passage. It would be in the original passage where the prophets had spoken that. And so they look it up. It's Isaiah 53. When I read Isaiah 53, I wonder why Jesus mentioned that phrase in his concern for the coming hours, being numbered with the transgressors, would at first glance seem to be the least of his problems. There's words in Isaiah 53 like you will be crushed. There was a day, a time in Jesus' life when he read these passages in the Psalms and in Isaiah and knew that he would be the suffering servant. And today, that day, he's ready to tell his disciples what he knows. If the gospel, the death of Christ, the birth of the church, the rejection of his kingdom by Israel is brand new in the New Testament, then Christianity is a cult. The theology, the gospel itself, has to come from the Old Testament. or it's not God's story. And the disciples didn't get it. Read all of Isaiah 53. But for now, it's well summarized in the last few verses. To begin reading Isaiah 53 in verse 9. He, the suffering servant, was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death. Though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit found in his mouth, yet it was the Lord's will to crush him. In the King James, I believe it reads that it pleased the Lord to crush him and cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering, he will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. After the suffering of his soul, he will see the light and be satisfied. By his knowledge, my righteous servant will justify many, and he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will give him a portion among the great, and he will divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his life unto death and was numbered with the transgressors. For he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. Three things the disciples had to have learned when they found that passage. And all three of them had to wipe them out, one at a time. Each in its own way. Each with its own impact. Number one, the king has to die. I never imagined. It was a plan from the beginning. It's not failing. King has to die, and he knew it a long time ago. And we were ignorant of it. While we were arguing about who was going to be the greatest next to him, he sat there in that room knowing he would die. He tried to tell us, but it's all been part of the original plan. And the second one, the second of the three things, is that he would die for us. Not just a trade life for life, but a trade of iniquity for iniquity. I didn't think we were that bad. I was ready to pick up a sword and charge Rome, Peter's thinking. All the time not realizing that I had an iniquity problem, a lawless problem, an enemy of God problem. This substitutional penalty for sin is all through the Old Testament. It shows up in Genesis 3:15. This that we're watching is the bruising of the heel of the serpent crusher. This which we're watching is why Abel's death offering was significant to God, but Cain's was not. This which we're watching is the fulfillment of the guilt offering, and it's mentioned by name in this passage, that Jesus was the guilt offering. And we didn't get it. He was numbered with the transgressors so that they and we don't have to be numbered with the transgressors. And thirdly, it was not the Romans that sobered Christ when he said, I will be numbered with the transgressors. It wasn't Caiaphas that he worried about saying guilty, or the Jewish leaders that cried out, crucify him. In all those ways, he was numbered as a transgressor. But when he gave him that passage, he said, my God and my Father will look at me and punish me because I'm a transgressor. I've got a hard way to go. It will please my Father to crush me for my sin, and they're not mine. They're yours. It must have been a humbling and joyous evening, if it was an evening, when they sat around together and read Isaiah 53 and realized they not only have a king, but they have a Savior. And the plan was from the beginning. And the promises just fortified the fact that God's plan never fails. God is so good.